Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello. It's the first day of spring today recording this.
Is it the first day of spring recording this?
It is. It's the equinox.
Of course it is. No, it's not. Now, it's the 20th. No, the 21st is the equinox.
No, today is the spring equinox.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll take your word. Oh, yeah. I'll take your word for it.
The 22nd is in September. That's the autumnal one. But I just want to say, you know, I just thought there's got to be a band or an album called Equinox, right?
Of course there is, isn't there? Hang on, there is, isn't there?
But there's
hundreds of albums called Equinox.
Well,
isn't it? I bet there's a million jazz fusion instrumental albums.
Definitely. But anyway, Styx had an album out in the 70s called Equinox, and it had a Roger Dean cover. Did you ever get Styx? I never.
Do you know what? I was about to say, I bet you were not checking for Styx in the 70s over here.
Never. No, never.
They occasionally showed up in the music papers, and it was just like, ah.
You know. But I have to say, have you seen them now?
No.
They all seem to have the same face surgeon.
Right, well, they clearly won't be coming on anytime soon. I'm going to get a shameless plug in, Gary, because you and I, the Rockonteurs, are the proud sponsors of the Rooker Prize.
Yes.
And I went to meet all the good people. This is a brilliant thing. This is Lewis FC. This is my new local football club, who are amazing, who just had a valiant battle, the women, against Manchester United, and did very well, but didn't make it through to the FA Cup semi-finals. But this team is amazing. It's the only team on earth where the women and the men get paid the same. And they're involved in all sorts of amazing community stuff, one of which, they're called the Rooks, and so one is they've started this prize called the Rooker Prize, which is for writers, and all you have to do is write the first 250 words of a novel. And the Rooker Prize is sponsored by Rockonteurs.
Do they wear it on their T-shirt?
On their jersey, I should say. I think that costs a bit more.
Right. Can I just say that you only have to write 250 words of a novel? I've done that about 10 times.
Who hasn't? Yeah, who hasn't? I know, they're going to be inundated.
Someone told me everyone has a novel in them somewhere, don't they? I mean, what would your novel be?
But I've tried. The best one ever is Peter Cook's line, wasn't it? When he met someone he thought a bit dreary at a party, and he said, "Oh, so what are you up to then?" And he said, "Oh, actually, I'm writing a novel." He went, "Really? Neither am I."
I know. It's like being in Soho House, isn't it? And everyone tells you they're writing a script.
Yeah.
Anyway, Harvey Goldsmith.
Okay, now this man, Gary. Now I don't know because you're so very, very much older than me. It might be different for you, but I don't think it is.
I use the same face surgeon as Styx, by the way.
From the second I got into music, this man was the gold standard of gigs. He was the Harlem Globetrotter, wasn't it? If it said Harvey Goldsmith, it only said Harvey Goldsmith. If it was The Who, if it was The Stones, if it was Led Zeppelin, it was the era. Yeah. He's always been just a cut above.
The back of the enemy, isn't it? That's what you were looking for. Harvey Goldsmith presents.
Presents, yeah. And he invented that thing of the one-dayer, the one-day show.
Oh, was that at Crystal Palace? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, the Pink Floyd one was him, I believe.
Yeah, well, yeah. And you, of course, you've
saved it. This is gold.
Well.
Save this.
You've worked with him as well, with Gilmore as well.
With Gilmore, or with Floyd. We've got a funny thing. I was recently a judge with him on the panel of a Hungarian classical prodigy talent show on
right,
TV.
Right. Well, you know, I did Live Aid with him.
Well, exactly.
I just want to do my bill.
So did he not promote Spandau? Well, Spandau kept everything very in-house.
Yeah, we promoted ourselves. Yeah. But I just want to do a quick rundown, my Bill Frindle moment, and just say these are some of the bands that he's promoted. Yes, Genesis, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Queen, Eagles, Elton John, U2, Madonna, Stones, The Who, Springsteen, Oasis, Rod. I mean, he managed Jeff Beck as well.
That's right, yeah.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Morning.
Hey!
Harvey.
Harvey.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I haven't seen you since Budapest.
No, indeed. Well, you've been busy on the road and I've been running around, you know, different places.
So what are you two doing in Budapest?
We're both involved in a very interesting program called Virtuosos, which is helping find the next generation of great young musicians. And we're both judges and they film it in Budapest.
And it's, yeah, and it was quite terrifying because it's with proper grown-ups. It's like the conductor from the Met, Pavarotti's old pianist and opera singers. And then there's me and Harvey, the sort of English meat and two veg at the end.
Yeah.
But at least you got the advantage. You've got the advantage, Harvey, being able, you'd literally say, I'd put you on at the Albert Hall tomorrow. And you can!
Yes. Do you have paddles?
No paddles.
I actually went over the other week... Harvey, that I got, they had a sort of a winner's concert with Placido Domingo singing. You'd have loved it. It was an arena.
What about the arena? Sorry, isn't there a guy that's just like him called Placebo Domingo?
Yeah, he doesn't work though.
I couldn't go because I've used nearly all my days up.
That's right, I heard that.
I've only got 2 days left.
Hang on, it's only March. How'd you do that?
Welcome to Brexit.
Well, just...
No, but it's only March. You got 90, isn't it?
You've got to work back 180 days. And how many... If you've done nearly 90 in the 180, you've got to wait until you've worked it through. So it's a bloody news. I've got to wait till April before I can go back to Europe.
Oh, my God. Listen, I think you just explain, because I don't know whether I fully understood it as a kid. I sort of understand it now because I'm in the business. But just to explain to people what a promoter does.
The very expensive wet nappy service.
Basically. Yeah, that's not helping.
The promoter basically works with the manager, the artist or the agent, depending on his relationships, and takes care of the live side of an artist's career and takes all the risks. So the artist decides he wants to go on the road, or it depends on, with me it's a bit different because I get involved with the artist directly and figure out what they want to do rather than dealing with it fourth hand from an agent. All he wants is the money. The agent's responsibility is to book the dates with no responsibility. The artist, the promoter's job is to make the dates work with all responsibility. So it's the buck stops with the promoter, really.
The sort of level you work at, Harvey, so I've, and with the greatest respect to sort of Neil Warnock and John Giddings people.
But they're agents.
But why is there an agent? That, do you know what I mean? It's like you're going to play Wembley, and you know, yeah.
A very good question. Why?
I've opened a can of worms.
Strangely enough, I have spent most of my life not working with agents, and they all have big photos of me and they throw darts at it because I've always worked with either the artist and the manager or the manager, and I call myself a coordinator because I take care of everything. So I'll deal with anything. Well, you know, I worked with Elton John for 3 years, and I'd go see the record company. I'd work out when he should go on the road. We'd work out the promotional campaign. I'd work out all the venues he wanted to play, and he would tell me, I want to play this or I don't want to play that. And he'd put the band together. I can always organize the rehearsals, and with many artists, I also organize their production.
Because like with Bowie, there was none of that, was there? It was just basically him to you.
Yeah.
But seeing what Guy's saying, you know, the artist thinks, I'd like to go on the road, goes to the manager, who then takes a percentage and phones the agent, who then takes a percentage, who phones the promoter.
And then the promoter then gets stuck.
Right, okay. But I understand.
The promoters don't get the credit that's due, really. Most, I have to say, I'm probably unique in this world because most promoters are part of a circuit. So if you work in, you know, the Czech Republic, you've got Prague. And if you work in France, you've got Paris and all the other cities. But that's your limit. So you're part of a chain where the agent gets much more involved and puts, he'll piece together the tour with all the different promoters and you do your section. Most of the acts I work with them from the get-go. It's just a different relationship. And I don't know why, but it's always been that way with me. And I don't have a problem with dealing with the agents, but as long as they don't get in the way.
So you always had a thing, Harvey, where, because Gar and I were saying that, like, ever since we've been going to gigs, you were the gold stamp, right? You always have, if it says Harvey Goldsmith, and in fact, it only says Harvey Goldsmith above it, if it's someone massive that you really want to see. And I'd say, you're the only promoter who's sort of famous in the way that some of the famous, like Andrew Lou Goldham or Kit Lambert, say, are. You have that. I mean, you know, you're famous for your little soirees on stage. I remember the first time I ever worked with you, which I was a tiny cog in this thing, when I was playing for Ice House and we opened for David Bowie at Milton Keynes.
Yeah.
And there was a thing where we go on and then everyone would start to get a bit excited because they'd be worried about it. And then they'd start to move forward a bit. And then between us and the next band, you would come on and tell us, right, everyone just move back. If everyone could just move back. To the point where, as we were doing, by the second day, I'd actually altered all the call sheets so that it said sort of 4 p.m. Ice House, 5:15 Harvey.
Well, to be honest with you, most promoters hide. And I'm not saying that disparagingly, but they do. They hide. They sit in their office. They do their box office settlement. They never go out front. They don't listen to anything. And they take the money and off they go. I have a different view in life in that I'm concerned what happens when ticket buyers leave their homes. Because I can always tell with a show whether it's going to be good, bad or indifferent. If they've had a problem getting in, their nanny didn't turn up, they got stuck in a traffic jam, the bus was late, the train got stuck, whatever. They get to the venue and the security guards are a bloody nightmare and ticket taking's a nightmare. By the time they get in to their seat, it takes three numbers before the audience even starts to calm down and get into the music. So I can always tell that. And I've always been concerned about what the public see and what they do. So I'm quite renowned for beating up sound engineers, front of house sounding engineers, because they're all deaf. Where it's so loud, you just can't hear it. I mean, today things are a bit, you know, obviously the technology's moved on. And similarly with safety, I've always been deeply concerned about the safety of the audience who can go a bit nuts and not realize it. You only need, as what happened in that dreadful Travis Scott accident last year or year before last, where something like 800 people were injured and 11 were dead because there was a panic down the front. The layout of the site was completely wrong. I mean, totally wrong. If you look at it, they created a funnel. And when people start to push back and they're dancing, they're pushing forward, they don't realize that somebody in the front's getting squashed. And you only need one person to fall down, then they get trampled on. And then it's, so that's why I did it. It's not for my benefit. It's to kind of make sure the audience are safe.
Is the, I mean, obviously you put your name out there, front of house. There seems to be a lot of facelessness about promoters now. The Live Nation conglomerate, you know, that.
Well, it's a different structure. Again, with me, if there was a problem, I don't mind dealing with it. So I get, you know, I get punters writing to me all the time, good, bad, and indifferent. But if I don't hear from them that there's a problem in a particular venue where they've got bad security or the front of house doesn't work or whatever, how the hell do you know? So I've never shied away from my responsibility, if you like, to our audience who are keeping us all alive, to make sure they're okay, because they're the ones that buy the tickets and they're the ones that, you know, they pay for everything. But you also have a duty of care to make sure that they have a smooth ride and they can enjoy the act. That's what they're there for. They don't need the other aggravation.
Talking of which, sorry, I don't think we've ever talked about this, but there was a particular night that we were both at,
yes,
at Earl's Court in 1994.
Correct.
When I was the one who had to go and tell Rick to stop.
So this is with Pink Floyd, right?
It was with Pink Floyd, the opening night, yeah.
It was really weird. It was quite strange. We started the show. I then walked out to go to the box office, the front of house, to make sure everyone was in, because there was a huge queue, and it was quite slow. I just wanted to make sure that everyone had got in, and if they hadn't, had pushed them in, yeah, get them moved forward and all the rest of it. And I got about 20 yards past the back stand, and suddenly I heard this very strange noise, and I looked round, and I could hear there was a problem. I rushed back, and I saw what had happened. The whole stand collapsed. It was an absolute miracle. There were 1,400 people on that stand. The stand collapsed, and one guy broke his leg. That was it.
Wow.
Couldn't believe it. Yeah. But I literally rushed to the stage, grabbed a mic, walked on stage, and had to stop the show, and then try and orderly get people out, because most of the audience had no idea what was going on.
I mean,
it was an effect.
That's just it. That's what I'm saying. The problem is because, you know, being Pink Floyd, we had this, there's this half hour pre-show tape, and there isn't a sound on earth that hasn't been co-opted by Pink Floyd. Baby crying, phone ringing, helicopter, machine gun, anything.
Yeah.
Stand collapsing. And you just think, oh, mate, they've changed the tape.
Yeah. It was pretty hairy, but it was a miracle. It was really was a miracle that,
I guess someone lost their job over that. How do you follow the line of paperwork?
Well, I got to tell you something. I rushed back. I couldn't find the hall management. I go into the manager's office and I found someone, and I called the health and safety executive. Saturday night, called the health and safety executive, and the person that answered, who was on weekend call, said, I told him what happened. He said, is anyone dead? I said, not as far as I could see. And he said, well, we'll deal with it next week. Put the phone down. At which point I went nuclear. And the problem was that it was the local authority had signed off the stand. They signed off the dynamics and the, because it was Earl's Court's responsibility to put the seating in. And the buildings inspector had been around in the afternoon, signed it off, everything's fine. I'm not an industrial designer.
Yeah.
And if he says it's fine, it's fine. But they wouldn't take any responsibility at all. All of them passed the buck.
Who got sued?
I got sued.
Jesus.
Even though my contract said otherwise, I got sued. It ended up being the usual insurance company, you know, situation where they took it over on my behalf. And to be honest with you, I felt that the people that should be responsible was the local authority and indeed the health and safety executive. That's who they work for. And they just said, oh, it's nothing to do with us.
Do you know what I found amazing about that was that, because of course we were told to just leave. So I came home. And I was home by 10 o'clock. So I watched the news at 10. And we were the lead story ahead of the unionist ceasefire in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a journalist, but frankly, I would have had it the other way around.
Well, it was quite unusual at the time. As I say, there were 1,400 people on that stage. It was a miracle that nobody
But, and of course, the Vox Pop they got from some guy who was in there, of course, goes, oh, no, I thought it was an effect. And then I saw all the blood everywhere. It's like, no, you didn't.
Funny. And that guy, I mean, he came to every show that the Floyd, it was, it's really funny.
Yeah. Harvey, let's talk about how you got into this business. And yes. I'm guessing that the reason you know, Harvey Goldsmith promotes, you know, obviously now we've turned into these Live Nation companies, but it's because this was for young people and at colleges and it was at local places.
Yeah. I came in through the university route.
Yes.
I went to university very quickly. I went to university to study pharmacy. I went to do a particular...
It was perfumes you were into, wasn't it, Harvey?
Yes.
Are you still? Do you have a nose on you?
Yes. So I was interested in the whole perfume, cosmetics, the marketing thereof and how it all works and all the rest of it. I went to do this particular course. The course got stopped 6 weeks after I got to university. We were given a choice either to wait a year or to... register for an external London University degree, which is purely theoretical, which is the reason I went to Sussex in the first place, not to do that. I got really fed up with it, got involved with student union. I became RAG chairman because I thought, to hell with the course, I don't want to do this course. We raised a lot of money, and then I went to a student union meeting, and I'm listening to all the various societies talking about the bridge club and the football and the cricket, the rugby and the blah, 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 the debating society. And I said, where's the social life? And they all looked at me and said, who the hell are you? I said, I'm from pharmacy. And they all kind of laughed. And they said, what do you suggest? And I said, I think we should open a club. And the president of the union kind of looked at me, and I was right at the back of the hall. There was about 1,000 people there. And he said, all right, clever Dick, go and open a club. So I said, okay, I will. So I did, for students. And we opened it. It was called Club 66. And I opened it in January 1966. By the summer, end of the summer term, I was on the finance committee of the university because we were bringing so much money in. And then I've never looked back.
What bands did you have on?
Well, I mean, the bands that I was working with were The Move and The Action and The Moody Blues and Fleetwood Mac, people like that. They'd all started. It was those kind of bands. And Manfred.
Did you get The Who? Did you ever get The Who down? Because I know you're a master. You're such a Who
I did
man.
Much later, but I'd worked with The Who separately.
Well, I know you later, yeah.
So even though music was in the family, and I was brought up on listening to a lot of music, and I used to go out to a lot of clubs and stuff. But this was a whole other thing, and it just became an instant hit. And then we opened a second club, and then I ended up booking shows, putting on shows across 12 colleges and universities on the South Coast, from kind of Hastings to Weston-super-Mare. And I wanted to stand for president of the union, and my professor, who said, you're here to study, not to be involved in student union activities, and refused to sign off my nomination. And as a sop, he sent me to America on an exchange course. And I went to America on this exchange course. He sent me to this wonderful place called the University of Toledo in Ohio, which is in space, but they happen to have a very good pharmacology course there for some reason or other. I lasted one term. I had an aunt and uncle who lived in New York. I went to New York, and I saw an ad in the paper for $99, 99-day unlimited travel on Greyhound bus. And I went from one side of America to the other. And I mean, I saw more of America then than I've ever done. I went to places.
Which way did you go? Did you go south, north, or through the middle?
I went kind of the north side of the middle on the way up,
right,
and the south side
past
of the middle
lakes
on the way back. Ended up in San Francisco. As we're going over Golden Gate Bridge, I was going to stay at the Y in downtown San Francisco. I saw this melee of people, and I could hear noise, music.
Is this 67? Is this 1967?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
And I dumped my stuff at the Y and kind of asked around and found my way back to Golden Gate Park. And there was the Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service playing. I wormed my way backstage, as one does, and I'm the biggest promoter in England. And it was just, you know, when you go to the first time you go to America, and you speak, and people say, oh, talk to me.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Well, especially then.
So I met the Grateful Dead and befriended them for 30 years thereafter. And they spiked my drink with acid. But 3 days later, I woke up.
That's very generous of them.
They kept telling people were coming up to me saying, don't have an open glass. If you want a Coke or a drink or water, get a can or a bottle. So I said, okay, I'll get a can. But they opened the lid. I didn't think about that. Anyway, they spiked my drink. And 3 days later, I woke up in Peter Fonda's house. Don't ask me why.
Oh, my word.
And I have no idea how I got there or what happened.
I've never heard that postscript to that story before.
Probably got there on the back of a Harley or something.
Yeah, exactly. Were you locked in an embrace with Dennis Hopper?
But before we continue on that story, your idea of bringing big bands to university, was that common then? Or did you, because really I don't sort of see that happening until a bit later.
No, it wasn't common.
Well, wasn't it? The only American bands, I'm sorry to interject, it's the early 60s thing, seemed to be there was the Package Tours. And then there were all those blues artists who were coming over who would then get English pickup bands, which are people like Ian McLagan and John, all those people got to play with those. That was basically what was coming from America, wasn't it?
That's true.
I mean, my question is, do you think you started the kind of idea of college being a place for big bands to go and perform in?
No, I don't. I can't take that credit. I'd love to, but I can't. I was one of them. I wasn't the only one. There were other people in other universities doing shows, but I befriended an agent at Marquee Artists because the Marquee was the golden, you know, that was the golden place to play and to go. And they had an agency. And I befriended a guy called Trevor Wichlow, who was an agent, and we became really close friends. And he would tip me the wink on every act that moved. And I remember very, very early days being taken to a studio where Eric Clapton was doing some of his very early recordings, and he was still playing with John Mayall. And I did a show down in Brighton, and funny enough, about 6 or 7 years ago, somebody sent me, just out of the blue in an envelope, the flyer for that show. And I put on the flyer John Mayall's Blues Breakers, and I put underneath featuring Eric Clapton. John Mayall went nuclear. Did the show. He screamed the place down. I thought he was going to kill me. He didn't actually talk to me for about 20 years after that because he said, how dare I do that? It's his band. It's not for you to decide who's what and who's where.
But why did you do that? I mean, was Eric's name known, or was it just because he was so phenomenal?
Because I'd heard him play in a studio. I thought he was unbelievable. And, to me, he was a rising. There was no doubt about it. He was a rising star. And that was the end of it. About 20 years later, I'm at the Blues Fest in Australia, which is quite a famous festival.
Oh, yeah.
And there's John Mayall playing. And I went to watch the show, and I went back to say hello to him. And he looked and said, I'm still not talking to you. We're completely.
He'd come over to you specially to say that.
It was just very funny.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I was just lucky because in that period, 66, 67, 68, 69, every week there was another act of someone special.
Oh, gotcha.
And I then decided I'd had enough of university and dropped out. And a guy who was became the kind of press secretary or the PR guy for the student union, and also doing all the PR for all the gigs, because we were doing quite a lot of shows then, left as well, and we set up shop together. And his name was Michael Alfandari, and he was a bit of an eccentric. He and I started in business together, and we set up a circuit. So we had a club in Harlow called the Birdcage. We would do regular gigs, believe it or not, at the Hemel Hempstead Pavilion, where we had everybody from Jimi Hendrix, one of David Bowie's very early shows, one of the first shows Elton John did, from Hawkwind to you name it. It was unbelievable the number of acts that we that played for us through that route. And then from Hemel Hempstead, we started to do shows at the Roundhouse, because Michael was a young conservative agitator and persuaded Camden Council at the time to have a kind of arts and music arts festival, and they said do it at the Roundhouse.
So did you put Hendrix on there?
Yeah, we started, yes, and at Hemel Hempstead. I've still got the poster, Jimi Hendrix at Hemel Hempstead Pavilion. Go figure that one out. He was unbelievable.
So brilliant. So, yeah, next week, Run For Your Wife with Arthur Lowe.
So we started doing shows at the Roundhouse, and they became really successful. And we were doing...
Were you involved in the International Times ones? Although, no.
Yes. Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
So what happened, very simply what happened was, whilst I was in San Francisco, I was walking around the streets looking at these unbelievable posters advertising shows with artists I'd never heard of. But the posters were so strong that I thought, I don't know who this act is, but these posters are telling me I've got to go and see the show. And I realised the strength of it. So I went
Who was the designer of those posters? Do we remember?
It's the guy did all the Bill Graham ones, isn't it? All those.
Yeah, actually,
the design really had very little to do with the band, didn't actually
Andy
tell you.
Andy Mouse was one of them.
It was an Art Nouveau revival, wasn't it? And over here, obviously, we had
Martin
David
Sharp.
David English.
Yeah.
Hapsash.
So wait a minute. So I went to see the two protagonists. One was a guy called Bill Graham that you all know is no longer with us. Bill Graham rang the Fillmores, and there was another guy called Chet Helms, who nobody ever talks about. Chet Helms rang the Avalon Ballroom and started a very famous poster company called Family Dog. Were the designers and producers, some of the best posters around, along with Bill Graham and people like Stanley Mouse and people like that. So I did a deal with both of them. I said, I'm the biggest poster distributor in Europe. No idea. I came back with a contract to distribute Family Dog posters and Fillmore posters in England. I get back. I'm looking at the Evening Standard one night, and there's an ad staring at me, which said partner wanted for poster company. So I went to see this guy called Peter Ledibar, who just set up shop at Kensington Market, which is quite a famous place. And we started Big O Posters together. And I went to him. He was printing and selling posters. He was selling Martin Sharp posters, for example.
Right.
And he had just started Big O Posters, and I joined up with him for a year. In return, we got the rights for the gatefold in the middle, the posters that Martin Sharp did, which is always the gatefold in the middle of the magazine, to sell. And then when Oz got busted, they said to me, you've got to help us out. We've got to raise money to pay for, John Mortimer's legal fees. And so I did the 14-hour Technicolor Dream, which was at Alexandra Palace.
Wow, my God.
That was for International Times.
With the beat poet.
David Hopkins. And then I did John Hopkins, sorry. And then I did Christmas.
Is that John Hopkins who run UFO?
Yeah.
Right.
And then I did...
Did it make any money?
Yes. Everybody had a good time. Everyone had a wonderful time smoking it.
Had a helter skelter, didn't it?
Helter skelter in the middle. As you walked in, there were two plastic domes. As you came in the front entrance, give you a ticket, there were two plastic domes, and inside were two naked, very nice ladies, and it was filled up with bananas. And as they walked in, a hand came up, and everybody got a banana.
Brilliant. Apparently, Pete Townsend turned up at about 11, and it was still the 60s. The world was still very formal, and he'd obviously come from some dinner party, and he was in black tie.
It's
a fantastic image.
So yeah. Floyd played, right? Did that Floyd? And Allen Ginsberg. There's some footage of Allen Ginsberg running around naked outside. Is that? Am I getting that confused? Or
yes, and also Yoko Ono. I did this stunt with Yoko Ono, where on the side of the stage we put a ladder, and we asked a young socialite model to sit on top of the ladder, and she was wearing a sheet, and Yoko and I got up on stage and we made an announcement. Would you please come up and cut a small piece of...
If everyone could just move back.
Peace. And during the course of the evening, people would like look around and they rush out on stage and they cut a bit of the sheet up. Till eventually there was nothing left. And suddenly there were a lot of press at the Ballypally gig. And it was filmed. It's a very, you can see the documentary, you can get it online actually. Suddenly there was like mayhem going on because there were only three bits of cloth left. And the press went loopy. And anyway, the photos and blah, blah, went off for weeks and weeks. Who is this girl? What, she turned out to be the daughter of some duchess or duke or something like that. And so on. And it was just a funny stunt. But
did the police come? Have you ever had, at that time, the police must have been raiding everything, weren't they?
No, they didn't come. Well, if they did, I wasn't aware. They didn't stop the show or anything.
Right, but did you ever find yourself dealing with police because of drugs being smoked in venues, etc.?
Yeah, pretty much. But they were... I never had a problem with the police. They were always pretty good, actually. I did have a bit of an issue with the Hells Angels once, but then I...
Tell us.
Who turned up at a gig and decided that they wanted to do the security. But then one of them got busted and was taken to court. And I went up and gave him... went to court and gave him a... clean bill of health, saying how wonderful he was and he'd help old people and all the rest of it. He got off. I then became a hero to the Hells Angels because I'd saved one of their key guys called Buttons. So there was all that going on. And
The Goldsmith chapter.
It was just one of
those. No, it was always the Windsor chapter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which seemed really incongruous. That's the ones you always heard about, the Windsor chapter. Really weird. Windsor.
Yes.
And then international, as I say, Oz got into trouble. They needed to raise money to pay for lawyers and the obscenity trial. So I did a show at Olympia with Jimi Hendrix and the Animals. That was pretty amazing. And we called Christmas on Earth, and that helped pay for the legal fees. So I was constantly being shoved away from doing posters to, doing concerts.
Just to finish off on the posters, did a chap called Dave Vaughan ever come into your world?
Yes, absolutely.
Dave Vaughan is my eldest son's grandfather, or was.
No kid.
Yeah, it's Sadie Frost's dad, yeah.
Ah, how funny. We did a lot of David Vaughan posters. They were all done on silver.
That's right, I've got some down the stairs, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a miserable bugger. He always used to come in moaning.
Terrible. I've got a lot of those posters, actually, ones you were mentioning about San Francisco. I'll take some photographs. We'll put some up online.
Yeah, they were really quite incredible. So I've got one foot in the poster camp, and then I keep being pushed away to go back to do concerts for people. And I can only tell you, I do this speech that I do around the world called Luck and Timing. And it was just luck and timing because, I remember getting called by David Bowie's manager, who was telling me he's got the greatest act in the world. And I didn't know who David Bowie was, of course.
It's De Vries. It's De Vries at this time.
Yeah. And De Vries was calling him out. You've got to book him. He's going to be the biggest act in the world and blah, blah, blah. I said, I've never heard of him. He said, well, you've got to come. So I went to see him. And sure enough, I remember putting him on at Hemel Hempstead thinking, this is going to cost a lot of money because no one's going to turn up. And they were queuing up round the block to buy tickets. I couldn't believe it. But David always came back to me. You know, he was. We became quite, good friends over the years.
But Bolan, you were saying.
And then I started working with Mark Bolan, and then I was, and my two favourites were the Who and the Stones, and I lucked in. Marquee artists were the precursors of the Reading Festival. So Harold Pendleton, who owned Marquee, started the festivals. They were called the NJF Festivals, National Jazz Federation. And they were the precursors of what is now Reading.
Oh, was Richmond one of those?
Yes.
Wasn't that? Yeah.
So my friend Trevor Wichlow, who was one of the chief agents at Marquee Artists, phoned me out and said, come down to the festival. He said, we need some help down there. Will you come down for the weekend? I said, yeah, absolutely, love to. And what happened was that Trevor and I ended up doing the car parks, which we had to man the car parks. It was like 1 and 6 for a motorbike and 2 and 6 for a car. So we used, and then whatever you want to charge for a coach. So we,
and £3 for a gypsy caravan.
Yeah. And we were making it up as we went. And we were stuffing these cars in. It took some of them a whole day to get out. We were literally just stuffing them into the car park. And we would get it. It was ridiculous. And on a Sunday night, the Who were closing the festival, and the stage manager had got ill or had an accident or something. And next thing I know, I'm on stage sorting out the Who and getting them together. That's kind of how I really started working with them. And
there's footage of that gig, isn't there, I think, of that one?
Richard. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
There's footage of everything somewhere. And I got friendly with them, and then I started working with Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp. And then I met Bill Coe, obviously, and Peter Rudge, and we've remained lifelong friends. So,
did you do Leeds, the Who Live at Leeds?
No, I didn't. So. That was done by the university.
Oh, okay.
So as much as I'd like...
It was done by a younger you did that.
Yes. As much as I'd like to take credit for all these iconic gigs, I wasn't responsible for all of them.
You know, we're talking about you being, you know, the nurse, as it were, the wet nappy chap. Working with a band like The Who, working with someone like Keith Moon.
Yeah.
I mean, what stories are there around Keith and getting him on stage? I mean, it couldn't have been easy.
I mean, how long was it funny for? Do you know what I mean? I mean,
it got quite sad at the end, actually.
Yeah.
He got very depressed. I remember we were on the road. We were at Leicester. I think the night before he dropped a television from his room into the pool because the pool was straight down. He thought it was a good idea. And the next day he phoned me up. He said, come over. And I went over to his room, and there he was standing. He was ironing his clothes. I did a double take because I thought I'd never seen that before with an artist ironing their own clothes. He loved it. He loved ironing. Don't ask me why. And I sat there, and he was in a bit of a state. And I said, what's the matter? He said, oh, you know, I don't know how long I can keep doing this. You know, I've got to a point now where I'm acting every night and I have to go on and perform like an idiot. I don't really want to be an idiot, and so on and so forth. It was quite a strange conversation. And then I think it was 3-4 months later, he was gone.
Oh, wow.
So he'd been, at first, it was just the energy. The Who, it was one of those strange things. The Who were allowed, there was a premium circuit, which was the rank cinema venues. And there was a whole circuit of them. They were all really big cinemas, had great seating and big stages. And they were all over the country. There were about, I think, 9 or 10 of them. And if you were lucky enough, you were allowed to play the rank circuit. But when the ranked circuit first started, they had kind of vaudeville shows. So we had to do shows where we had to have a funny act, an MC. We had to have a crooner. We had to have a rock act. we had to have a speciality act, like we had a trick cyclist or we'd had a puppeteer or some madness. And then we'd have the a break, and then we'd have the MC back again. We'd have the trick cyclist in the second half, and then his ball would go on. I mean, it was nuts.
Oh my God.
I started working with Deep Purple very early on, and they were one of the first bands that came to me and said, we want to do a whole show. And I said, I think that's a bloody good idea. And they said, we want to do a whole show. And, you know, we want to play at Hammersmith, of course, because that was the venue in London. And I toured them everywhere. I took them all over the world. Anyway, it took me 6 months to persuade Rank that one act could do a whole show, because they couldn't get it. They were worried about ice cream sales and drink sales and this, and you've got to have an interval. They said the audience will all go home and they'll want their money back. I go, no.
Where's the trick cyclist?
It took me 6 months of persuasion, and I kept going and kept going, and eventually they agreed to it, and all of the senior directors of Rank came down to watch the show, and they all had extra security ready, standing by, because they thought there would be riots. People wanting to leave, they want their money back. They were
completely, let me out!
They were completely blown away when they saw the show and how well it went. It was unbelievable.
Was there no support out whatsoever?
None. They did 2.5 hours straight off. And then,
do they still have to do 6:30 and 9:30?
No.
Because they all did matinees in those days as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In the 6:30
and 9:30.
You had to do 6:30 and 9:30. You didn't have a choice. Yeah. So I remember at the Rainbow, there was a show with Engelbert Humperdinck was the headliner. Pat Stevens closed the first half. Jimi Hendrix opened the show and just blew everybody away.
Wow.
Jimmy Henny, who was from Radio Luxembourg, was the MC DJ. And there was a bloke who on a
Zampo the strong man.
Yeah. You can't figure a lineup like that. And it was twice a night.
Oh my God.
Jimi Hendrix went on stage and did his whole thing with lighting the guitar. I mean, the audience, there were people kind of, most of them were in the pub because they wanted to see Cat Stevens or Engelbert Humperdinck. And people were just flying in the venue because the word got out about this lunatic playing and they couldn't believe their eyes.
And what was it like? What was it like for you to see Hendrix?
Oh, it was fantastic. And I there was a very famous club called the Speakeasy. In the West End, in Little Portland Street. The Speakeasy was the place where every artist within south of Manchester, when they played their gig, was go to the Speakeasy. And they all used to hang out there. And they always used to jam together. They used to finish their gig in Birmingham, Wolverhampton, you know, Watford, wherever it was, go to the Speakeasy. It was open late. And all sorts of people.
I'll say how late. It must have been very late.
3 o'clock.
Because they've all stopped at the Blue Boar on the way.
Yeah, they'd all stopped at the Blue Boar. 3 o'clock, 3:30. And then 3:30, you had to be out because then the police were around. But every act, and people like Hendrix, he'd be there all the time. And Manfred Mann was there all the time. And Mike Hugg, Manfred Mann's drummer, and we became mates. And I used to hang out there 2-3 nights a week. And I got to know everybody. So that's really helped me on my pathway.
I should ask you about the garden party. We were talking about that before you came on.
Oh, yes.
And how that developed, because really that was all part of the open air festival.
Well, the garden parties came about from the Roundhouse. One night, the director of entertainment from the old GLC, the Greater London Council, which is now the GLA or the Mayor's Office, came to the show. Came and found me. His name was Les Franklin. Very nice chap. Suit, tie, everybody else looked like God knows what. And he said, can I have a word with you? So I said, yes. He said, I've been watching what you do and seeing these popular music concerts that you put on. He said, we've got a place called Crystal Palace. Have you ever heard of it? I said, well, I've heard of Crystal Palace. He said, but in the middle of Crystal Palace is a bowl. And we do 4 to 6 classical concerts there a year, and it's completely underused. Would you like to come down and have a look at it and see if you could put on one of your popular concerts? Mm-hmm. So I was with Michael. Michael and I went down there, and we couldn't believe what we were looking at. This is beautiful bowl with a lake in the middle, yeah, and this conical stage. So we started the first of the garden passes. And the first show we did was the Pink Floyd, The Faces and Mountain, which was Leslie West and Jack Bruce. Right. And
was that the octopus one? Was that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah, the octopus coming one out.
And they sunk the octopus in the middle of the lake. And that was the first show we did. And then we did I think we did 13 or 14 of them over the years.
I went to one. Did you do that? I went to it. Was Eric Clapton and Albert King.
Yeah.
I think it was 75 or 76. But I remember going there and just thinking, I can't believe this is London, because it's literally, it's like this Hollywood bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
With a lake in front of it. It was so magical.
Did that still happen down there? What's happened to that place now?
Well, they're redoing
the octopus's bread. They've taken it.
They took the conical stage down last year. They did a concert, but they did it on the site of the old Crystal Palace, not on the lake. And the lake was magical. I remember we did Andy Williams there in a white suit, and we built a pontoon right out into the water. And he looked like he was walking on water when he performed with Keith Moon. We did the Who there with Keith Moon. Demanded a helicopter. We had a helicopter. And he virtually did a loop-the-loop over the roof the bowl.
My God, he wasn't flying it himself, was he?
Yeah. The last concert that I did there was Bob Marley's last concert. That was amazing. Yeah, it was absolutely amazing.
Harvey, you invented the one day, didn't you?
Yes.
The idea of
basically
because you didn't want the headache of
festival.
Camping.
Exactly. Yeah. We got involved in the Wheelie Festival, which was a well known disaster. And there was another festival that we were working with Stanley.
What was the Wheelie Festival? What's the Wheelie Festival? You're not getting away with that.
When people used to shout out Wheelie.
I don't know this.
Wheelie was a field.
What, like on a bike? On a bike, you mean?
No. Wheelie was a little village in the middle of nowhere, and there was a field, and these guys had the idea of doing a festival and asked us if we'd help put this festival together. It was an absolute... There were no fences, no... I mean, it was just one of those disaster things. It was in the very, very early days. But it became quite infamous, and people used to go around the gigs shouted out, Wheelie!
Fantastic.
I came to the conclusions that festivals are actually a pain in the neck, and that if you did a really good one-day concert, you get as much out of it as doing a festival. You could enjoy it, it was easy and whatever, even if you did 2 one-day concerts. So I started doing one-day concerts in stadiums. I was the first guy really to do that. And I enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed
that. What was the first one of those? What was the first one of those? Because I remember seeing The Who in 17...
It might have been The Who or The Stones at Wembley Stadium. Because there's so many Wembley Stadium shows.
Because I remember seeing The Who in 79 at Wembley Stadium. And that was a really great bill. Yeah. It was like 4 or 5 bands on. Charlton was like that, wasn't it?
Yes. Charlton played twice.
You did Yes, yeah, didn't you? Doing the Relayer show at Loftus Road.
Exactly. Did all the Yes tours, all the Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Emerson, Lake and Palmer we played at White City, actually, when it was a dog stadium.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's that famous documentary, isn't there, with the three Arctic glories.
Yeah, we did Frank Zappa Emerson, there. Like,
and we did, three Arctics.
Yeah, we did Frank Zappa.
I know, Emerson, Lake, Palmer.
Yeah.
That's why they had three. They didn't need them.
I know. Can I just do a sidebar here? Because there was a chap, I just thought of him, something you said. A guy called Jesus that used to be at every single concert that I ever went to when I was a kid. Do you remember him? Did he ever get free tickets? What was it?
We ended up, he became a kind of mascot. We just used to let him in. He would turn up at every single big show we ever did.
Yeah. It's like the ravens at the Tower of London, isn't it? If Jesus stopped.
Yeah, I mean, if Jesus wasn't dancing near the front, you thought, I'm at the wrong show.
No, right? You're absolutely right. That's quite right.
What was his name?
Let him in. I don't know. He was just...
He made a record with someone in the 90s and he got involved with some trancey, ravey thing.
Yeah,
I think.
Probably with Youth.
He just danced on it. I don't know.
He never really spoke that much. I mean, he kind of was just there. He would just arrive. But as you know,
the funny thing is, he was always
at the front dancing.
Was he even called Jesus? Was he just given that name? Did we just call him Jesus? Yeah. You know, did he know?
He used to wear a white smock, didn't he?
White smock, beard, hair all over the place. And he was always in a trance, always.
Yeah, and if anyone...
It was brilliant, but he sailed through punk and everything. Yeah. Character, didn't he? Although it was fantastic.
If anyone knows more about Jesus or has come across him or been next to him, let us know. Guy, that was amazing. And we've got more to come, haven't we?
We have got more to come because Carvey gave us so much. And even though, in time-honoured tradition, we have barely scratched the surface. So what we've got next week, Gary?
We've got Live Aid and so many tales from that. We've got getting Pink Floyd back together and we've got getting Led Zeppelin back together. This is, I can tell you now, there are some fantastic stories coming up. So, get yourself onto Rock on Tours.
Because I was just going to say, I just remembered something in the middle of that. Because so much of his stuff is about fundraising and everything like that. Earlier, I was talking about Lewis FC. There's just a little nugget of information, by the way, which is that in 1968, they needed new floodlights for the pitch. And so some guy who worked for the local council thought he'd organise a gig to raise some money for it. And so Pink Floyd played at Lewis Town Hall, and it was one of the only gigs where it was the five of them. And in fact, it was the last gig before the famous Southampton one where they didn't bother picking up Sid. And that's what paid for Lewis FC's
floodlights. Incredible. That's incredible. And now Rock on Tours are behind Lewis FC.
Exactly.
Makes sense. No, what I was going to say was we, of course, forgot Jean-Michel Jarre.
Oh, my God,
Equinox.
We did.
How many albums? I don't know. Equinox.
Turn the machines back on!
Yes. Anyway, we're back next week, and it won't be the Equinox, but it will be more Harvey Goldsmith and some incredible tales. Thank you to Ben Jones.
Exactly. But in fact, we're going to wait till the autumn Equinox, and then we're going to have an Equinox season, I think.
Thank you to our producer, Ben Jones, and thank you to Harvey Goldsmith. Good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions, for Warner Music Group UK.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.